You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm a happy camper today because today my guest is Pauline Kael on the occasion of her 10th collection of movie criticism, Movie Love. It's her 12th book. It marks a, for most of us, very sad experience, her departure from The New Yorker, but also, I guess, a time of new beginnings for her, other kinds of writing. I thought it would be nice, because the introduction to Movie Love quotes a young Los Angeles critic named Chuck Wilson, who has come to interview Pauline with me today in the studio, and we'll both be talking to her. Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Pauline.
I thought I'd give Chuck the first question.
Thank you, Michael. It's wonderful to be here and to actually be able to have a conversation with Pauline. We've only had the briefest of telephone, mostly message conversations. Pauline, if I'm going to be quoted in a book, I can't think of a better book to be quoted in than in one called Movie Love, since Movie Love governs so much of my life. When does Movie Love start? You mentioned in the front of your book that your grandson is the most avid of movie lovers. When do you see that in a youngster?
Incredibly early. My grandson still believes in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy, but he just gave me a very cogent analysis of Doc Hollywood.
So what did he say?
Oh, he analyzed what was good about it and what was bad about it, and he made me want to see it. Something that hadn't even occurred to me.
Well, maybe we can get him to write in some future day.
I think really kids start awfully early on movies. It's such a total medium in the way it hits us. And I'm often struck at The New Yorker by how widespread that love is, because I get mail from people from remote places, you know, rural areas in Canada that I've never heard of before, or strange islands in the Pacific, and they want to talk about movie experiences, not only recent ones, but they want to remind themselves and me of movies that affected them when they were kids. It's great. It's a great medium because it does affect people so hugely, so intensely, and in such widespread areas. It's one of the reasons I've loved working at The New Yorker, that it reaches people all over the world.
Tell me, does that feeling, you know, you virtually became the anatomizer of movie euphoria, bringing to the prose style of criticism, you know, enormous subjectivity and a precise detailing of what it feels like to see a movie. Does that feeling go away as you went through your years as a critic? Did you find yourself losing it?
I think it became more intense. I think I feel it more acutely now because I don't try to fight it. When we're young, we still have all that academic baggage, and so we feel we shouldn't risk sounding like fans. It was one of the things that struck me about Chuck Wilson's writing when he sent me a book that he'd put out, and I saw that he was willing to go with those feelings of fanishness, that he didn't disown them, that he didn't try to make himself an academic critic. It's one of the things that I'm disappointed in people who were said to be influenced by me, that they retain that academic baggage, and they so often have a kind of fake objectivity, and they don't go with their direct responses.
Well, I find it's really difficult in the daily papers or even the weekly news magazines. I know that they're supposed to be a little more distant than, say, you can be in a twice monthly column, but you really do lose a sense of who they are and where they're coming from. So that when people ask me who they should read as a critic, I always say, well, find one that you emotionally connect with, and that seems to get harder and harder.
It is hard because so many of them are afraid to give a direct response. I mean, they give an educated response. If you look at the reviews of Barton Fink, a picture that makes me want to shriek with anger, I don't find anybody who gives me a direct response. I find all these learned responses. They think they should appreciate it, or they don't like it, and they analyze why they don't like it. But they don't give us that direct emotion at any point.
That's interesting, Pauline, because, you know, in over our years of conversation, I've been astonished at the at your ability to, what would you say, how do you do it? How do you get rid of all of the tricks of intellectual response?
I don't know if I get rid of all of them, but I try to be ruthlessly truthful. And I'm not scared. I think most of them are scared. I think maybe because I got into print later in life, I'd cast off those fears early on. Most of the critics now start very young, and they're very nervous. They want to be considered intelligent. They're frightened of being considered, you know, fans or sillies.
Is there, I noticed, could it be because of universities that there seems to be no, I can't think in any field of criticism, there seems to be no one who's burst onto his or her platform with the force with which you entered with that review of Bonnie and Clyde. And I wondered whether it might not be because so many people are taught now, studying criticism or films in universities, and fulfilling some kind of obligation about what writing about them might mean.
Well, I think they come to films later in life. They don't go to movies as kids the way I did. And so it's an educated response. Often they started with Ingmar Bergman, or they start with even later figures now. They don't start with that kid sense of that stinks. And that's a very important sense to have. But remember, when I wrote about Bonnie and Clyde for The New Yorker, I had over 20 years of writing about movies behind me. I mean, I'd written for Partisan Review and Sight and Sound and Film Quarterly and all sorts of magazines for many years. They were scattered pieces, and so people didn't really register me, but I was learning to write more freely. I think the more educated I got, the more willing I was to write like a kid.
That's very interesting, too, because I think about that title. I often think about it in relation to your work, Isaac Bobble's collection of short stories called You Must Know Everything. And one of the great joys is reading someone who is an enthusiast, but who nevertheless has kept up on all of the fields of the arts. How do you do it? How is it done? How does a young critic proceed?
Enormous curiosity about everything. I mean, I don't get to the theater or the opera as often as I like. I don't even get to art shows now as often as I like. But I crammed myself full of them when I was younger, and I think they spill out in the reviews. I think it takes enormous confidence in yourself to be a halfway decent critic. I mean, right now, actors are often pulling pictures behind them. You know, they transcend the material or the movie making. We just don't seem to have very confident movie makers at the moment. But we've got actors who you know, treat the movie like a box that they've got to fight themselves out of. I mean, I'm thinking about Bill Murray and What About Bob, or the three marvelous women headed by Diane Keaton in Crimes of the Heart. Or even Robert Duvall in Days of Thunder. I mean, just extraordinary performances that come through, performances that transcend the roles. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer in Married to the Mob or The Fabulous Baker Boys, Christopher Walken in Almost Anything. You know, there's something interesting going on in the fact that people initially went to movies to see the stars, and then they became educated and wanted to go for the filmmakers. Well, right now the filmmakers aren't very interesting, but the critics don't seem to have noticed it. They're still talking about the filmmakers when it's the stars who are interesting again.
I wonder if one of the reasons the filmmakers aren't interesting, there aren't very many films that are messy. everyone seems to be so controlled. I suppose that's part of the Spielberg, Scorsese 70s thing where everything seems so pre-planned. De Palma, everything, every shot was planned. And there's not much room for things to spill over the edge of the frame. Some of the movies that we see now, they're prepackaged before you go in. There's nothing for you to wonder about as you watch them.
I think it's more than that. I think it's that the directors don't have the subjects that they're excited about working on. And when they do, they often take a beating at the box office. And so they retreat into something the studio wants to do, and it turns out to be some dumb big action movie. And there's just no way for them to show any personality or art there. What got us excited about movies in the late 60s and 70s was that the directors really were doing something personal and crazy. I mean, people like De Palma and Scorsese and Coppola and Altman were really saying something new. And there hasn't been much said lately that's new that the audience has responded to. About the only recent film that I felt had a fresh feeling to it was Truly Madly Deeply, the little English picture by Anthony Minghella, because for one thing, Juliet Stevenson simply gives a performance that's overpowering, but for the other thing, I've never seen another movie which was about the comedy of grief. It's a totally fresh subject matter.
Oh, that's you all over, Pauline.
Well, I love to see something I've never seen before, the same way I want to read writers I've never read before.
I'm talking to Pauline Kael on the occasion of the publication of her 10th collection of movie criticism, Movie Love. Tell me, if you were starting out to write now, I suspect you wouldn't be writing about movies. What would it be?
I'm not really sure. I might want to write about acting for a few years because I have become fascinated by acting. One of the disappointments of Katharine Hepburn's new book, Me, is that it barely touches on what made her such a great actress. And I looked in vain for some recognition on her part of the difference between her great roles and her mediocre ones, and the difference in her feeling about her great performances and the mediocre ones, and there's no indication that she knows the difference. I think acting is just an overpoweringly fascinating subject. But what would I write about? I honestly don't know. Early on in my life, I really was interested in writing about jazz, but movies were always with me, and I wrote better about movies than I did about anything else. would I write about books? I'm not sure. I would love to write about some of the classics. I think I'd love to sit down and write about Middlemarch. But in terms of journalism, in terms of writing about what's going on now, I'm not sure. The arts don't seem in a very exciting period.
Really, Pauline? Middlemarch?
Middlemarch, I adore.
Oh, that would be so interesting to see what a unedited response to a Victorian novel would be like. Are there any critics that you read who do that kind of thing, who have a freshness?
Book critics are peculiar. Every once in a while you read an essay by somebody that's absolutely wonderful. But there are very few regular critics writing about literature who are worth reading, I think.
I thought that essay by Harold Bloom on Edgar Allan Poe was very funny, full of curves.
Yeah. But what I want is somebody who will write about new books in that way. And that's what I don't find. Sometimes Jim Walcott comes forth with something. I thought he was interesting on Cheever this month, but he's awfully curmudgeonly, and his tastes tend to be reactionary at times. But I don't really know. Sanford Schwartz writes marvelously about art, but I don't see too many young writers who really excite me, and I do think it's because of the state of the arts at the moment. I think the writers will come along if the arts come along.
Mm. What was the last time you felt that shock of recognition at a new artist?
Pedro Almodovar in movies. I mean, he's doing something that nobody else has done. I mean, a movie like Law of Desire is almost inconceivable 10 years ago. And Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Matador and his other pictures have something bizarrely goofy. I mean, it's a homoerotic sensibility that's absolutely free. And we just haven't had that in movies. It's been fun. His last picture was mediocre, and that was depressing, but maybe he'll bounce back.
What does happen to... How does a De Palma, you've seen this for a long time, and I think your heart must sink and rise on regular bases. How does a De Palma end up with a Bonfire of the Vanities? Is it just bad luck, or?
There's a new book that's just coming out. I've read it in galleys by Julie Salomon, who followed the production of the Bonfire of the Vanities, having no idea when she started, I'm sure, that it was going to be a disaster. And it records the executive decisions at every step. And when you read it, you understand exactly why that film was a terrible failure. I mean, with the best will in the world, De Palma had lost confidence in himself because some of his greatest movies have been financial failures. I'm thinking of Blowout and Casualties of War in particular. And so he listened to the executives. He didn't fight them at every step the way he might have fought them earlier. And they wanted everything in the book sweetened. And by the time you sweeten the central character and the other characters, there's nothing left of the satirical point of view. It's a heart-rending book.
One of the things that my friends and I often talk of these days, Pauline, is that... It seems that audiences are less patient than they used to be. I wonder if a movie like, say, Mean Streets came along now, if even though that film wasn't a huge financial success, if there would even be an audience for it now. Have
there
the audiences changed?
There wasn't much audience then. I got a lot of hate mail for recommending it. People were very angry about the profanity in it and took that very seriously. But would they respond to a terrific movie now? Well, they didn't respond to Casualties of War. That's only a couple of years ago. I think it's very hard to get audiences to respond to anything original in a movie. And I guess that's always been true. I think one of the first pieces I ever wrote was something called Movies, the Desperate Art. It was about the failure of people to respond to Peter Brook's The Beggar's Opera and Jean Renoir's The Golden Coach and many other great movies of their day, movies like The Earrings of Madame Deux. I mean, most of the movies we consider classics were not well responded to in their day. And even at video shops, people tend to take out those damn things that get Academy Awards rather than the interesting movies they missed.
I was at a video store recently and browsing, trying to find something, and there was a group of four or five young people, 17 or 18 years old, and desperately scrounging the long new arrivals wall. They couldn't find anything, but they never, ever thought to turn around and walk into the stacks. I was dying to go over and pull them over and say, why don't you look over here?
That's true at colleges, too. Kids at film societies want to run the recent movies. They don't want to run the earlier ones because they're afraid nobody will come. I spent a great deal of time this year expanding my 5001 Nights at the Movies. It's come out in a huge new edition, 945 pages, and I kept thinking this will give people in video stores a chance to look up something and see if it's worth renting. But I don't think any video stores are stocking it.
It should be like there should be three copies open all through the store. It's always at my bedside.
Oh, thank you.
It is. It really is.
I'm talking to Pauline Kael on the occasion of her publication of Moving Love. It's from Dutton. And I'm also joined by Chuck Wilson, a young Los Angeles critic. One of the things that sort of took my breath away when I read Chuck's self-published book, Flickers, was from the essay you quoted from Pauline about Barbara Streisand and an intensity of personal response. You've always been prodded, joked, and kidded about your direct response to actors and their physicality. I know that people have made suppositions about your sexual preferences on the basis of your descriptions of both men and women. Is that intrusive writing? How do you feel about being that sensual in response?
How can you love movies and not be sensual? I mean, that's one of the things that makes us prefer movies to other art forms when we're kids. I mean, a play just doesn't bring the people as close, doesn't make us that aware of their sensuality. And it doesn't give us the intensity of a performer with the same directness that a movie can. It's one of the things we love movies for. I used to be kidded for the sexual titles of my books. They were absolutely consciously chosen to try to indicate how directly movies could affect us. And I find that educated people want to fight that direct response. They don't seem to realize it's one of the greatest things we have available. Barbara Streisand affects people so directly because of that intensity of her presence. But there are other people. When you see something like the Kevin Costner Robin Hood, what's amazing is that he seems a non-entity on the screen, but Morgan Freeman and Alan Rickman, both partly through the force of their voices, have terrific sensual presence, and they compensate for the vacuum at the center of the movie. You know, it's the voice often, not just the face. But it's one of the things that made Orson Welles such a phenomenal performer. Every time you heard that voice, you just jolted upright in your seat. And when you hear it now on television in an old movie, it gives you that same kick you got the first time. Well, there are just so many aspects of movies that can affect us in that special way. And there are particular performers who seem to have it more intensely than other people. I mean, the great stars have it. Angelica Houston had it in Preetzi's Honor, and she's had it in just about everything since. Annette Bening seems to have it. And when you feel it there, you know that there's some kind of charge that you really don't get from anything else.
I wonder, though, you spoke recently in an interview, and you said that audiences, or that I guess we as a society weren't very hip right now. And I wonder, people go to the movies now and they seem to have notions of what hip is. Kevin Costner, I guess, is hip, which makes no sense, but he seems to be hip. I wonder if audiences now, maybe it's always been true, they respond to movie stars because they feel that those are the ones they're supposed to. Those are the hip ones to respond to.
When really they're missing it. Can a Republican be hip? I mean, there are certain kinds of Republican sensibility on the screen, and I don't know if the people are actually Republicans, but you know what I mean. There's a kind of blandness that's bred in certain personalities, and it depresses me when I go to the movies and see that happening. I want something sharper, something fresh. I do want something hip, but it's almost a little nervous making to use that term now.
Could it be that since many movies have turned out to be about yuppies in one form or another, yuppies in repentance, yuppies at play, yuppies marauding, that the republicanism of recent movies has been drawing the most unhappy blandness from a lot of young actors?
Oh, I think that's true. I think with different directors, Kevin Costner seemed alive in Bull Durham. He isn't alive in Robin Hood. But there are pictures that have a strength, and the audience doesn't seem to respond to it. I mean, the Russia House had a marvelous performance by Sean Connery, maybe his best, or at least his best since The Man Who Would Be King. And audiences didn't go to it, maybe because of the title, maybe because the material was complicated. But the movie has a lot of fun in it, and people didn't seem to respond. The Grifters was not nearly the box office success I would have hoped for. I mean, it had terrific performances. Young John Cusack is quite amazing in it. But audiences, I mean, it's always a fight with the audience. The audience has to be brought along, I think. It's only rarely that a performer simply knocks the audience out. I mean, the great thing about some of the performers from Saturday Night Live and Second City TV was that they do affect the audience in a large sense. I mean, the audience does respond to Steve Martin or to Rick Moranis or Martin Short, and that's great. I mean, they bring something out of the audience. Bette Midler brings something out of the audience. And maybe there's something about people who are trained in comedy who make more direct contact with the audience, and God knows movies need that, because big, serious movies are not reaching the audience at all.
Well, it's interesting you should mention getting a reaction out of the audience, because recently I saw the new Liza Minnelli musical Stepping Out, and there's a scene in that movie where she does a solo dance number, and everyone seemed to suddenly be paying attention like they weren't before. People are rushing out to see The Commitments. Everybody's talking about the new Bette Midler musical for Christmas. There seems to be something there.
Well, I hope they'll respond. I think one of the tragedies for movies in modern times was the failure of the MGM Pennies from Heaven, because had that been a hit, we might have had some great musicals following it, and practically nobody has made musicals following it. We did have Stop Making Sense and The Last Waltz, the terrific concert films by Jonathan Demme and Martin Scorsese, but we haven't really had musicals. I think maybe the closest we've had was the Chet Baker movie that Bruce Weber made called Let's Get Lost, but even that, of course, only reached a very small audience.
Well, I guess I still think of musicals as they were in the old days, where suddenly they just burst into song. Are we too cynical to sit still for a musical where modern characters suddenly burst into song?
I'm not. I loved American Hot Wax. I mean, it had a lot of pokey, dumb passages in it, but it had Jay Leno and Fran Drescher and a lot of terrific people and a lot of good performers. Even that as a musical failed. It's been very tough to get an audience to oddball movies.
I have a final question, and it's the obligatory question. It's one I expect no answer to. But being one of the most secretive people I know, will you at least hint at what will come next in writing from you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not finished with The New Yorker in the sense of if I publish something, it will be in The New Yorker. But I'm not sure what it will be. I do feel I need to do something fresh and new. I mean, I've published 12 books on movies, and that's a lot. And I don't want to repeat myself. And as you get older, you do feel your powers diminishing. If I'd felt I could go on reviewing movies, I certainly would have. My health wasn't up to it, and I felt I had not much more that was new to say, and I didn't want to turn into an old bore. So it's been a matter of trying to renew myself. I'll see what happens.
We'll be waiting.
Thank you.
My co-interviewer today has been Chuck Wilson. Thank you, Pauline, for being with us.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go.